Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and we're bringing you our feature in-depth interview followed by some new music from Ukraine. This week's interview is with historical theologian Professor Yaroslav Skira. Marta Dychok asks him about the background and significance of the newly created Ukrainian Orthodox Church. That will be a little further on, but first of all, this week's news. Ukrainian Orthodox Christian priests selected a 39-year-old bishop to lead their newly independent church. Priests gathered in Ukraine's most prominent 11th century St. Sophia Cathedral early on the 15th of December and for 8 hours celebrated the liturgy and discussed the status of the new church. They elected as leader the Metropolitan of Kyiv and Ukraine, Epiphany, also known as Serhii Dumenko. And in the Sea of Azov, well, Ukraine will send warships there to the Sea of Azov ports, despite Russia's seizure of 3 Navy vessels and their crew in the area last month. Oleksandr Turchynov, Secretary of the Council of National Security and Defense, said. He added that Kyiv would invite representatives of the Transatlantic Military Alliance, NATO, an Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, on board next time to prove Ukraine was not violating any regulations. HMS Echo, a multi-role oceanographic survey ship from the British Royal Navy, docked in Ukraine's southeastern coastal city of Odessa on the 19th of December. It is the first NATO warship to enter the Black Sea since Russian ships attacked Ukrainian naval vessels recently, illegally seizing 3 boats and arresting, or rather imprisoning, 24 Ukrainian sailors who still remain in Russian jails. The ship was also intended to support the planned deployment of UK Royal Marine Commandos to Ukraine for training efforts with the Ukrainian military under the so-called mission Operation Orbital. And there have been new provocations. Pro-Russian terrorists and certain Russian media are spreading fake reports claiming Ukraine forces are preparing an offensive near Mariupol, including the use of chemical weapons, according to the Deputy Minister of Information Policy of Ukraine, Dmytro Zolotukhin. The Russian side has crystallized the strategy of yet another disinformation operation, which could result in a full-scale provocation by the Kremlin, which Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, has scheduled in his interview with Komsomolskaya Pravda for the last decade of December. Meanwhile, Ukraine's security service has reported on the arrest of 3 sabotage groups deployed by Russia's military intelligence in eastern Ukraine. And good news as far as new aid from the IMF and the World Bank is concerned. Well, the International Monetary Fund has approved a new $3.9 billion bailout program for Ukraine to stabilize the economy and help the government pay back its debts. The board provided the first $1.4 billion disbursement this week. It's part of the 14-month standby program, which replaces a bailout that suffered long delays as the government failed to implement the reforms necessary to release the cash. The program focuses on maintaining macroeconomic stability, notably through continued fiscal consolidation and inflation reduction. This will be accompanied by targeted reforms to strengthen tax administration, governance, the financial and energy sectors, and fighting corruption.
Ukraine hit the international headlines again, but with a good news story. It created an independent Orthodox Church on Sunday, the 16th of December. To explain how this happened and what it means, we have with us Professor Yaroslav Skira. He's the leading expert on Eastern Christianity. He's the acting director of the Metropolitan Andrei Sheptytsky Institute of Eastern Christian Studies at the Faculty of Theology at St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto, and he's also associate professor of historical theology at Regis College. Thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us, Professor Skira.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on the radio with you and to make your acquaintance.
Thank you. Now, let's start with the what. An event happened in Kyiv last Sunday that some are calling historic. Can you remind our listeners of Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling exactly what happened?
On December the 15th in St. Sophia Church in Ukraine, a unifying sobor or council happened that had brought together a number of Ukrainian Orthodox bishops, clergy, and laity towards the healing of schisms that have been plaguing the Ukrainian Orthodox churches over the last 100 years. And this essentially was an attempt to bring these various churches and clergy and laity into a unified structure. And here, when I talk about a unifying council, I'm referring to the three major jurisdictions in Ukraine, which was the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the so-called Moscow Patriarchate. And then there were two other churches called the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kievan Patriarchate and the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church. And those last two were seen as being in schism by global Orthodox Christianity for many years.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you explain to our listeners why there were three Orthodox churches in Ukraine until now? And what schism is?
Okay, certainly. The Ukraine had been attempting for many years to establish nationhood, and with that nationhood was an attempt to establish a singular Ukrainian Orthodox Church on the territories of Ukraine. And these attempts date back to the 1920s, right up to today. And what had happened in most recent times is that because of the Soviet Revolution and the rise of communism and the Soviet Union, the Ukrainian churches, both the Orthodox and the Eastern Catholics, were suppressed and subsumed under the Russian Orthodox Church. And it was only until the Ukraine declared independence in the 1991 that there emerged a Ukrainian Orthodox Church that would be proper to Ukraine. And that church began to seek independence from the Russian Orthodox Church. And through various attempts at independence, or what we would call autocephaly, that is self-governance, there were disagreements among some of the clergy with Moscow, which led to a schism, which basically means a division within a church. And part of that group remained faithful to being in communion with the Russian Orthodox Church. And part of the group formed what is known as the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kievan Metropolitanate, or the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church. And it's those last two churches that were considered to be out of communion or in schism with the rest of Orthodoxy.
What does that actually mean? Sorry to interrupt. They're out of communion, out of schism. Does that mean they're illegal, illegitimate? And again, why? There's the Russian Orthodox Church, and then there's these Ukrainian Orthodox churches that are in schism. Explain what that actually means.
Basic principle of unity within Orthodox Christianity is that a church is canonical. By canonical means, it is recognized by the other churches. It's recognized the celebration of sacraments. You can go from one church to another church and take the Eucharist and pray with them. But being in schism or division means that you are not recognized by these other churches. And so it's a form of disunity. And if you use a modern analogy from politics, it's like one state not recognizing the existence of another country and not recognizing its borders or its government. And that's what effectively happened to a significant portion of the Ukrainian Orthodox faithful in Ukraine. And this unifying council on December the 15th was meant to heal those divisions and to bring those various groups into a recognized canonical body.
Thank you. That actually explains things really clearly. So why did it take so long for this to happen? Ukraine declared independence in 1991, and this unification happens in 2018. What were some of the obstacles? Why did it take so long?
part of the issue has to do with Ukraine as an emerging state or country after the fall of the Soviet Union. In many ways, it was still under the control of the kind of the colonial imperial powers of Russia. It was still learning to walk on its own feet. And so you not only had this kind of remnants of imperial Russian colonialism, but you also had the same thing within the church structures. But in the 1990s, there were attempts to establish an independent Orthodox church, and those attempts failed. That's kind of where we are today. You didn't have unanimity among the various Orthodox clergy and bishops. You didn't have the goodwill amongst those who are in the Russian Orthodox Church and in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church to establish a distinct structure. And there were still, Ukraine was still a developing nation. So really, the process that we see today is a process of maturation, where you have not only the state reaching a point where it recognizes it wants to affirm its membership within the European Union, it wants to rid itself of corruption, it wants to function in democratic means. It also wants to shake off the tutelage of any influence from Russia. And with that comes the maturation also in the consciousness of its believers, who have been seeking for many years to see regain this kind of canonical status, where they would enter into unity with other Christians. And so from the Christian perspective, the problem is really the sin of Christian division, where you do not recognize a fellow Christian as being a part of your church or not fully part of your church. So this is kind of, there are many layers to why this has happened. And this just seems to be a time where you have the alignment of the stars, so to speak, that provided an opportune situation. And part of the opportunity is really something that had backfired for Russia and for the Russian Orthodox Church. In wanting to continue to keep the Ukrainian church under its tutelage, the war in eastern Ukraine and Crimea has effectively put a wedge between any goodwill or symbiosis that Ukrainians would have had in Russians, and that has further pushed Ukraine into developing this consciousness where akin to what happened during the Euromaidan movements, where you had the people wanted to affirm their own dignity, they wanted to affirm their independence, they wanted to affirm their freedom and to remove any shackles of this kind of a neo-colonial or imperial past and to affirm that this they were a Ukrainian nation and a people. And again, coming with that also includes the idea of the church wanting to affirm that it is a church that is meant to minister to the people on the territories of Ukraine.
Well, politics and religion have a very close relationship, as you've just been saying. To what degree is the decision that was reached in the unification of the church, is this a political decision? Is this a religious decision? Is it a little bit of both? And is the significance more political or religious?
I think you have to recognize that this is primarily at root an issue based within the church and the faithful. Here you have the churches wishing to affirm that they are a distinct entity within global Christianity, that they want to minister to their own faithful, that they want to be in union with other Christians. And so this is part of the a broader kind of movement within global Orthodoxy. It's also a political issue, because this is a way where Ukraine, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and Ukraine itself will see itself as kind of casting off any vestiges of soft power or influence that the Russian government and the Russian church would have in Ukraine. And so this unifying Sobor, it was held in St. Sophia, which is a very symbolic place, because in Constantinople or Istanbul, there is this major church also called St. Sophia, which was traditionally the center of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. And the Ecumenical Patriarch is really kind of exercises a leadership role within all of the independent Orthodox churches. And he's recognized as a senior and elder among the Orthodox churches. And this was also recognition on the ecumenical patriarch's side that he must do something to heal this schism and division within global Christianity, within global Orthodox Christianity. And so that's, like I said before, this is a kind of an alignment of all of the stars in the situation that had come to the fore that really brought this church to this council. And I think when you look at the videos and the images from the actual Sobor itself, in answer to your question, you look at the head table of all the delegates. In the center is the Metropolitan Emmanuel of France, who is a representative of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. He's chairing the session. To his left is Patriarch Filaret, or Metropolitan Filaret, who was the leader of the major Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kievan Patriarchate. And to the chair's sitting to the chair's right was the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko. And when they announced later on who the new patriarch or metropolitan of the newly established Ukrainian church would be, and his name is Epifani, on stage were two representatives of Ukrainian government. So to your answer to your question, primarily it's a religious, ecclesial issue, but that is tied very closely, obviously, within these Eastern Bloc countries to nationhood and statehood and part of the culture of an identity of a particular peoples.
There's also a historical dimension to this. You're a professor of historical theology, and you mentioned St. Sophia in Constantinople. The actual Sobor, the announcement of the Sobor happened in front of the St. Sophia in Kyiv. This is a symbolic historical spot for Ukraine. What is, if you could again just explain to our listeners the history of the sort of the ancient history of all of this, because sort of the separation from the Russian Church, the Orthodox Church in Ukraine, is it not older than the Russian Orthodox Church? And what is the symbolic significance of this separation, if you will?
Certainly. In 1988 is kind of traditionally taken to be the year in which Ukraine accepted Christianity from Byzantium. And Ukraine at that time, known as Kievan Rus, and Byzantium was the major empire at the time, which had its central capital city within Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul. And in that city was their major church, which was called Hagia Sophia or Saint Sophia. And the Ukrainian, ancient Ukrainian state and communities received Christianity from Byzantium, and eventually they built their own Saint Sophia Church in Kyiv in the 11th century, and that is that kind of that inheritor of the church that we are talking about today. So that, in a sense, transplantation of Christianity, the inheritance of Christianity from the Byzantine Empire into the Slavic lands, really has its roots within Kyiv, within ancient Ukraine, and it begins. So this process of development and expansion through Ukraine and north and northeastwards towards Belorussia, as well as principalities of Muscovy, which eventually turn into this kingdom of the Tsars and eventually modern-day Russia. And so the historic development, which is in part contested by Russian Orthodoxy and some of the ideology of the Ruskiy Mir within Russian Orthodoxy, and even within the President Putin's mythology of this kind of Russian state emerging out of this 988 event. In reality, the history and historical origins of Christianity in Ukraine and Russian Belorussia are really traced to their roots in Kyiv, in Ukraine.
So if I could summarize what you just said, Christianity comes to Kyiv in 988, and in 2018, Ukraine sort of reclaims its mantle as its own church. So it's not perhaps the schism, but it's a reclaiming. How will this all affect individual believers? Because we talk about churches and history and politics, but it's really about people who go to church and worship. So this big decision was taken, this big change happened at the highest levels. In what way or will this affect the way people are worshiping or people who are in these Orthodox parishes?
I think the primary reason for any attempts to heal disunity or schism in a church are so that one can be in unity with other Christians. And you had these multiple jurisdictions, villages which had two or three churches, and even families that were split amongst various jurisdictions. And formally, they could not participate in each other's weddings, be baptized by their priests, or intermarry or receive the Eucharist. And for Christianity, these are important markers of Christian unity. So at that level, I think believers will begin to see that there is this attempt, this unified church, which restores these dimensions of communion. And there's a caveat to that, because the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate and the Russian Orthodox Church has formally broken off communion with the Ecumenical Patriarchate and anybody they associated with the Ecumenical Patriarchate.
So this is in Constantinople, yeah?
Yes. So in effect, the Russian Orthodox Church has introduced a formal break in communion or schism as a result of these unifying attempts by Constantinople and Kyiv to heal the schism. The other dimension of this unity is that you will have a parallel jurisdiction in some places where people will want to maintain their ecclesial affiliation, whether that be a Russian Orthodox, whether that be Ukrainian Orthodox, but they'll at least have these options for this one unified church. They may notice some differences in the commemoration of which bishops get commemorated in the liturgy. Some of the churches will be adopting modern Ukrainian vernacular, and some will retain the older church Slavonic, which was used in parts of the Ukrainian Orthodox churches. And some will actually may even use Russian. But again, the whole point of all of this is to say that there will be perceived differences amongst these believers. But as with any major changes like this, these may take some time to really trickle down into the consciousness of the individual believers. There's a lot of disinformation going on in Ukraine. There's some mistrust based upon the past historical period of Ukraine being under the Soviet regime. And so this will be a slow transformation. And some parishes already signified their move over. And for some, it may take a little bit of time. Some may delay. But I think over time, you'll begin to see this larger, one unified structure of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, which will presumably also respect religious pluralism of other Christian traditions within Ukraine, like the Ukrainian Eastern Catholics, the Roman Catholics, Russian Orthodox Church will still be there, as well as other non-Christian faith traditions.
Professor Skida, you've been organizing a very interesting series of talks at the University of Toronto on this issue of Orthodoxy and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Something that I learned was that in the Orthodox Church, parishes have decision-making power that perhaps other churches like the Catholic Church have less so. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening at the parish level in the lead up to this this unifying gathering, the Sobor, and if you have a sense of how many parishes were in favor of this unification and what we actually saw at the Sobor, how many parishes from the church that was loyal to the Moscow Patriarchate joined this unified Ukrainian church?
I think that's a very good question, and the short and quick answer is some parishes were quick to want to signal their intent to join the new church or want to be part of Unified Church. Some may have split. There are examples where you have churches, the church doors locked, and the community shares two other buildings on the church property because of such division, and some will retain being in the church of their origin for now. In terms of history, one must recognize that what has happened now up to fairly recently has been happened fairly quickly in terms of historical time. We're looking for a period from that began really in April in the spring of this year, which really reached a climax in September, and then formally reached kind of a clarity with this unifying council in December.
That's quite amazing for an Orthodox church, or any church, to move that quickly.
It certainly is, and so it's too difficult to say, and I think we need a little bit more information for what's happening. I think some churches may wait still to move over, and I think it's important to remember here that this unifying council has not quite finished its work. December 15th was the council that had elected Metropolitan Epiphany as its primate. That primate had a speech where he welcomed others to join in Christian union within this newly erected church, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which is its formal title. But there is still a process where that church on January 6th has been told that they must visit the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople to receive the final statutes or declaration. It's called the Tomos. Which will basically declare this church as being self-governed or autocephalous. And that will be really the final step in this process. And I think some churches may be sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what happens and whether this church will be recognized fully as an autocephalous church. And I think you will have a slow progression, a migration of churches to this newly created church. Certainly, a majority of the people in the church have come from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kievan Patriarchate, and statistics from not long ago had placed that church as having about over 8.5 million believers. Whereas the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate had just under 4 million. So the larger church, the one that actually was considered to be in division, is the one that actually wanted to move towards unity.
Does the door remain open for those who still are sitting on the fence? Can they join later?
Absolutely. I think that is a message that's been quite clear from the newly elected primate of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church.
Do we have a sense of how many parishes from the Moscow Patriarchate joined this newly created church, or is it too early to tell?
We do have some indications. When you look at some of the news reports, and the reporting here has been somewhat scant about who attended and the names of people and the total delegates. So I did find a source that spoke about there being about 190 delegates to the Sobor. And if you think that every bishop was allowed to bring a representative from the clergy or the laity, so that roughly puts about 60 bishops or 60 plus bishops, maybe even more, who attended this conference, attended this unifying sobor. Majority would have been from the Ukrainian Church, the Orthodox Church of the Kievan Patriarchate. The next grouping would have been from the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church. And based upon some recent condemnations by the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate, we do know that two bishops were formally condemned and removed from their ministries, so that we do know that at least two Ukrainian Orthodox bishops from the Moscow Patriarchate were at this sobor. There's quite possibly a third one who had indicated his intent being part of this church, but was not one of those condemned. So there's a third one. Mm-hmm. I suspect there may be more. But again, this is we're only a couple days after the sobor, and some of the details of the attendees have not been released just yet.
Interesting. So this is, in some ways, a very important step has been taken, but there are other steps to be taken. What do you see as potential obstacles to this process, if there are any? Or at this point, is it sort of now just sorting out the details?
Well, I think when you look at institutional renewal, and here I'm talking in purely secular terms, when you look at institutional renewal, if you want some change from an existing leadership, you appoint somebody new. And I think that that's what happened with the appointment of Metropolitan Epiphany. He was a candidate which would have been widely acceptable by a majority of the bishops who had voted in favor of him. There were two rounds of voting, and he clearly came up as the top one. So as a unifying factor, he may be able to kind of give this church a fresh start and maybe a center of unity. Some of the obstacles, though, will be if there will continue to exist internal conflicts among the bishops over jurisdiction and territory and the question will be of who owns which property. There are a lot of church properties and associated buildings and monasteries, so there may be some conflicts that will arise. In this, we also have to deal with the threat of localized acts of violence, from kind of the subtle coercion to actual physical violence. And of course, what worries all Ukrainians is the increasing military buildup on its borders by the Russian government, which has shown it's not afraid to intervene and disrupt not only other democracies, but particularly of Ukraine. And the final area, I think, as an obstacle will be that we hope, and one hopes, that other Orthodox churches will recognize the existence of this new Ukrainian Orthodox Church and will acknowledge the efforts of the Ecumenical Patriarch to bring about Christian unity within Ukraine. And so this is a very important issue. It's that the other Orthodox churches recognize this Ukrainian church, because in many ways they're all independent entities and they function in this communion, again, which is led by the Ecumenical Patriarch. And so this process of recognition and not a rejection of this Ukrainian Orthodox Church will be important. And so far, this.
When
been,
is that going to happen? Sorry to interrupt.
This usually is a process. It takes time.
After January, then they'll have a certain amount of time for individual churches to.
The process has already begun, because some of the synods have been meeting and they've been saying we need more dialogue between the Ecumenical Patriarch and the Russians and Ukrainians, don't introduce further divisions. So this process of reception has already begun, but I think it's too far along to kind of turn back. And so there may be a process where a number of the Orthodox churches will say, yes, we recognize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. We bring them back into communion. We wish to celebrate Christian unity and the unity in the faith with these other groups. And so what the churches like the Romanians will be important to hear what they say, the Church of Antioch. We do know that some of the churches will side with the Russian Orthodox Church, like the Belarusian Church and perhaps even the Serbian. It's an important, I go back to my analogy of political states. To recognize the borders, the existence of a government, requires a recognition by other entities. Mm-hmm. And once you're recognized, then you can start functioning and being invited to councils, and you can pray together, and you can exist in harmony. And this is kind of that, if you would pardon kind of that secular analogy of me bringing into this, this will be a process. Again, as I said before, this has been a very quick process from April until now, leading up to it. In some ways, it's a brilliant process done by the Ecumenical Patriarch, because it's unfolded in steps. It's been collegial. It's been consultative. There's been a lot of lobbying on both sides, particularly on that of the Russian Orthodox side, which really has been in opposition to the granting of Ukrainian autocephaly. And I think it's important to point out that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate has never formally itself in recent times asked for independence, and it's constantly asking for the Ecumenical Patriarch not to interfere in its affairs, but it's still is functioning as kind of this a subsidiary seat to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Thank you for that analogy of the sort of a new state declaring independence, requiring recognition. I think that clarifies for people who are not religious experts. I have three more questions for you, but I don't know if we'll have time for all of them. So I'll throw the questions at you and you answer whichever ones you want. I'm very curious what your assessment is of the newly elected head of this Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This is a young man who has a lot of energy, but perhaps unknown for many listeners. The other thing is, what do you think will happen with the Monastery of the Caves, the jewel of the crown of the Ukrainian Orthodoxy, the Orthodox world? And thirdly, what, if any, actions do you expect from the Russian side?
Well, from the Russian side, the reaction has already come. They've had their own particular subor or councils, and they've condemned the activities in Ukraine, and they won't recognize this Ukrainian Orthodox Church. They've already effectively said that they're breaking communion with the Ecumenical Patriarch and everybody who's associated with them. And so this kind of shows you a disagreement or a conflict between the Ecumenical Patriarchate and Russia. Politically, again, I've alluded to the fact that the threat of violence from Russia is still very very much a reality for the Ukrainians. As for the newly elected Metropolitan Epiphany, he comes from a church in an area that's not too far from Kyiv, he's the Metropolitan of Pereslavl and Bielotserkva.
Historical sites.
This would be an area, an episcopal area, mm-hmm. where he would reside and have ministry, but he was also a member and an abbot within in the monastery there, and then as a rector of the Kyiv Theological Academy. So he has some leadership qualities. Clearly, he has many leadership qualities. If others had recognized that he should be the patriarch of the church. And it's also a somewhat risky move given his relative youth.
Oh, I think it's a great move. I think it's a great move. I mean, do you remember how old Filaret was when he was appointed?
Indeed.
37. Indeed, but, so he's older than Filaret was when he was appointed.
Indeed. There'll be many years of him being at the helm of the church, and hopefully that energy that he has and in his relative youth will translate into an energy that will reinvigorate the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And you had that third question,
about the Monastery of the Caves, Pecherska Lavra. What, if you have a crystal ball, what do you see happening with that?
Pochaivska and Pecherska Lavra are kind of the two holy sites within Ukraine, and currently they have been delegated to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, which I think for the interim basis will continue to exercise their stewardship over those areas. Some of those buildings on those two sites, however, are not in the possession of the church, and they are rather state-controlled or mm-hmm. state-owned. And so I think what the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian church will probably do is to affirm their right to these sites. And I think over time, the churches that are not directly part of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church will be slowly asked to move and to relocate elsewhere.
Well, let's hope that all happens peacefully. Is there anything you'd like to add? Because I've asked you a lot of questions. Maybe I forgot something.
I think we've covered most of the points that I would have wanted to cover. Again, this is a very historic moment that has happened very, very quickly. I think it's a very positive moment as part of the maturation of the Ukrainian state. But more importantly, it's part of the unifying attempts to bring the church in Ukraine into one body after years of divisions, after years of persecution and repression. And so this is a moment of, in a sense, a resurrection of Christianity in Ukraine. And I hope it will continue to spur a further renaissance within Ukrainian or this historical cave and Rus Christianity for many centuries to come.
Well, and it's coming at a time when the world is getting, the Christian world is getting ready to celebrate Christmas and New Year, so it's almost like a Christmas present that has come to Ukraine. We've been speaking with Professor Yaroslav Skira from the University of Toronto, an expert on Eastern theology. Thank you very much for your insight, and hope to have you on the show again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And now on to music. Well, a rosary for victory. Vervitsya na peremogu. That's the name of a song by Fata Morhana Ue, a band led by Ihor Roman. He's from Horluka, a town in the part of Donetsk, currently controlled by Russia-controlled forces. When the war began in 2014, he was captured by them and detained. Eventually, he was released and made it to Kyiv, where he found a few other musicians of like mind, and they formed Fata Morhana Ue. This song was premiered on Hromadske Radio in May. But with religion in the news again, we thought you'd enjoy it this week. So here goes, enjoy.
Слава Отцю, що нас сотворив, Отче наш. Слава Синові, що нас відкупив. Слава Святому Духові, що нас у вірі Христовій просвітив. Слава Святому Духові, що нас у вірі Христовій просвітив.
Господи Ісусе Христе, Ти, що переміг диявола, смертю смерть подолав.
Смертю смерть подолав.
Своєю відкупительною жертвою дарував життя всьому людству.
Смертю смерть подолав.
Прийми жертву нашого народу наших побратимів, що поклали своє життя на вівтар боротьби за волю і незалежність України.
Прийми як жертву відкуплення за гріхи наших зрад і чвар. Неможливо по стінкам сукоплення і молитись в хліві яничар. Ми рвемося у світлий політ, руйнуємо ордийський гніт. В махшанські болота існуй, святий Боже, в країну врятуй. Святий Боже, в країну врятуй. Врятуй. Святий Боже, в країну.
Благослови наш народ на спільну перемогу. Благослови наш народ на краще майбуття. Благослови наш народ на спільну перемогу. Благослови наш народ на краще майбуття. Ісусе, благослови нас перемогу. Ісусе, благослови нас перемогою. Ісусе, благослови нас перемогою. Ісусе, благослови нас перемогою.
Ісусе, благослови, Ісусе, благослови, Ісусе, благослови нас перемогою.
Look Looking forward. Well, Hromadske Radio, unfortunately, is facing a financial crunch. And it's appealing to listeners for support. Should you feel inclined to donate to keep this project going, please see the links we'll post on our site to the crowdfunding. And we would, of course, be very happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. Hromadske Radio, well, it needs your support. So if you can find the funds, please help us out in this difficult moment. And write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.